Just last week, a ruling was handed down by the Connecticut State Supreme Court, a decision that some believe could have ramifications across the country for gun manufacturers. That ruling and what it means is our focus today. Welcome. We're glad you're part of the full story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. Your comments and your questions are always welcome. You can reach us by email at tfs@wshu.org, and you can join us on Twitter. We're at Full Story WSHU. There are many aspects to this ruling and what it means. We need some background, and for that, we're being joined by Dave Altomare from the Hartford Current. Dave has been covering this story for quite a number of years now. Dave, welcome. Thanks for being with us. Thanks for taking the time.
Hey, Ron, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Pretty good.
Could we start at the beginning? How did this lawsuit start and why?
Well, the lawsuit was actually filed back in 2015 by the families of several victims from the Sandy Hook shooting back in 2012. And in effect, they sued Remington claiming that trying to hold them responsible for, at least partly responsible for the shooting, because they were marketing the AR-15, the assault rifle that was used in the Sandy Hook shooting and has been used in several other mass shootings. They were marketing the gun to basically what they knew was a military weapon to civilians, and especially to this group of people, like young male adults in their late teens and 20s, or guys who played video games, violent video games. So that was the genesis of it back in 2015. The case was in Bridgeport Court. The judge actually dismissed the case, claiming that the lawsuit had to be dismissed because of the federal law, which is known as PLACA, which in effect was a shield for gun companies that Congress put in place to keep them from getting sued. And this was a novel. There's been very few successful lawsuits since that law was passed by Congress. And this was a novel approach that the attorneys for the families took, trying to say that it violated Connecticut's consumer protection laws, that the company had violated the Connecticut's consumer protection laws.
You mentioned PLACA. That's the Federal Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act, the PLCAA. How long has that been in effect?
It was put back. It was actually approved by Congress back in the 90s in effect to keep gun companies went to Congress and said, we're being sued by, someone uses a gun and they're suing us. And they passed this law, which federal law, which has pretty much been a giant barrier to any lawsuits against the company since then. There's been very few that have made it through the dismissal stage when they get filed. And frankly, most people thought that this lawsuit would not make it past there either.
So the court ruled that the families should have the opportunity to proceed under the Connecticut Unfair Trade Practices Act, the CUTPA, if you will. How long has the state act been in effect?
That I'm not sure. I think for a long time. What they basically claimed is that Remington knowingly marketed the gun to people like Adam Lanza, and in doing so violated Connecticut's consumer protection laws. And that because they did that, they're not protected by PLACA, and that the families have the right to pursue that narrow issue of how the gun was marketed, which frankly is kind of what they have wanted from the beginning when they filed this lawsuit. They said that they wanted to know why and how Remington marketed this AR-15 and how they chose to market it to young adults that how they chose to market it to young adults. So they, in effect, have been given by the state Supreme Court, have been given the right to pursue that now.
What did Remington or its lawyers have to say about the ruling?
Nothing, actually. They haven't made a comment. Their lawyer hasn't made any comment. They have 10 days to... They have 10 days since the ruling was released last week to ask the court to reconsider their decision. That hardly ever works. I'm not sure if they'll even do that. They have 90 days to appeal this ruling to the U.S. Supreme Court, which is where I think most experts expect that they'll try to do.
U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal has compared this ruling and what it may mean to the lawsuit against the tobacco industry. Have you heard that from others?
Yes, although I think the case that it much more closely aligns is another one from down in your area, the Purdue Pharma lawsuits that are ongoing right now. Mm-hmm. In that case, Purdue Pharma is being sued for how they marketed OxyContin and who they sold it to and how they sold it. So it's very specifically about that one drug and what the company did with it or didn't do. So I think that's very similar to what we're seeing here. They're suing Remington about how they marketed one gun, the AR-15, the assault rifle. So I think those cases are very similar. It does have share some with the tobacco because the gun industry in general is very secretive. Not much has ever come out in court about any of their internal decision making. So it does share some of that, but I think it actually aligns very closely with what's happening with the Purdue Pharma.
Dave, one more question before I let you go. Is there any way to estimate a timetable when this legal battle may finally be resolved?
Well, the next step will be if they decide to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. If they do, and the court were to take the case, which they don't take very many, but I think this one is probably one. It's a pretty good chance, I would think, that they would take this case. If it goes to the U.S. Supreme Court, then basically everything in Connecticut comes to a standstill until there's a hearing by that court, and the court makes a ruling makes their own ruling. So, if they go that path, this case will probably come to a halt for quite a while, months, if not certainly a year. If they chose not to go to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, then the case has been remanded back to Bridgeport, and a judge will order discovery to begin. So that'll at least get the case moving forward if they don't appeal. But I even if that happens, we're certainly a long way away from this case ever getting to a trial, if it were ever to get to that far. I can't imagine that Remington would ever go to a trial in Connecticut against these families.
Dave Altamari from the Hartford Current. Dave, thank you. I appreciate your time and your expertise.
Thank you, Rum.
Take care. We'll talk with you soon. We have a number of guests today. We're going to start the next segment with Georgia State University Law Professor Timothy Litton. He has written a number of books, and he is the editor of Suing the Gun Industry, A Battle at the Crossroads of Gun Control and Mass Torts. Professor Litton, thank you for your time today, sir.
Pleasure to be here.
First, your reaction, please, to the ruling by the Connecticut Supreme Court.
I think that the ruling by the Connecticut Supreme Court came as somewhat of a surprise to many people. The primary issue that the court took on was they allowed the case to go forward under an exception to the federal immunity bill that Dave Altamari mentioned. In 2006, Congress passed the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, and that act was designed to stop a large wave of nationwide lawsuits against the gun industry that arose out of criminal misuse of the weapons that they sold, much like the case we're looking at today in Sandy Hook. And most of those cases ended after PLCA was passed, and PLCA was really designed to stop the litigation altogether. There are a number of exceptions to this immunity, and the key exception here in this case is that a firearms manufacturer or seller doesn't have immunity from a lawsuit if they knowingly violated a state or federal statute applicable to the sale or marketing of a firearm. And the question that arose in this case is the General Connecticut Unfair Trade Practices Act is a state statute that's applicable to the sale or marketing of the product. So the plaintiffs in this case, the Sandy Hook victims, argued essentially that the Connecticut Unfair Trade Practices Act applies to all sales, including firearm sales, and therefore it's applicable to firearm sales, and that if Remington violated that in the way that they sold the gun, they could be subject to liability notwithstanding the immunity. In response, Remington argued that applicable to the sale or marketing of a product doesn't mean possibly applied to or could be applied to. It means specifically designed to regulate firearms. And, of course, the Unfair Trade Practices Act in Connecticut is a general consumer protection act, and it's not really aimed specifically at firearms. The Connecticut Supreme Court on this issue sided with the plaintiffs and allowed the case to go forward in the trial court. And I think what that essentially did is it blew a very large hole in the federal immunity bill, and it opened up this exception such that pretty much every state in the union has a similar type of Unfair Trade Practices Act, and it leaves manufacturers of firearms vulnerable to claims that the ways in which they're marketing or distributing their practices may in fact violate unfair trade practices law, and that would subject them to the type of civil liability that many people argue the immunity bill was designed to put an end to.
Professor Linton, hold on, please. Timothy Linton, professor of law, Georgia State University. Coming up, we're also going to be hearing from Michael Hammond and Rich Burgess, gun rights advocates. You're listening to The Full Story on WSHU. A short break. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Full Story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. Today we're talking about the Connecticut Supreme Court ruling regarding the lawsuit against the gun manufacturer, Remington. We're going to continue our conversation with Georgia State University law professor Timothy Linton for a moment or two and then bring in some other guests. The professor is the editor of Suing the Gun Industry, a battle at the crossroads of gun control and mass torts. Professor, your book, from my looking at it, does really not come down on one side or the other. In it, you basically are examining the legal arguments. Can you tell us some of the arguments on both sides?
I think the primary arguments, there's a wide variety of arguments, but the primary arguments that the plaintiffs have brought forward that are relevant to today's case in Sandy Hook is an argument that manufacturers are engaged in the regular business of manufacturing weapons with a high degree of lethality, of marketing and distributing those weapons in ways that the plaintiffs claim and many people argue increase the possible risks that they'll be misused in crimes, and that they don't exercise control or supervision of dealers, so that dealers often who are rogue dealers who sell a lot of illegal guns, the manufacturers don't really keep an eye on their supply chain downstream. And the arguments are on the plaintiff's side that essentially these amount to negligence, that manufacturers are careless. They don't exercise reasonable care in the types of weapons that they design, the safety features they equip them with, the marketing practices they use to promote them, and the supervision that they might be able to exercise over their dealers. And that because they're negligent, when that negligent results in injury to gun violence victims, the manufacturers should be held civilly liable for that and pay damages. And that's the gist of many of these claims historically, both before the immunity bill and after. The manufacturers in their defense argue that it's simply not the job of a gun manufacturer any more than it is for a car manufacturer or a pharmaceutical manufacturer to worry what it is that people are doing downstream with their products or to worry about people like mass shooters who misuse their products, and that lots of legal products are used on a regular basis to commit crimes, but that doesn't subject manufacturers to liability for those crimes. And so that's really the type of argument that we're having today is what is the responsibility of manufacturers to police the possible misuse of their weapons downstream? And if there are things that they could do, are they responsible if they fail to do them?
So is this ruling, can this ruling be applied to any other industries outside of the gun industry?
Well, we've seen similar types of litigation regarding other products. The most clear parallel is with opioids, the idea that the manufacturers of OxyContin and other opioids overproduced them. In other words, they overmarketed them. They encouraged doctors to prescribe them aggressively. They gave premiums to doctors who put out a lot of prescriptions. They basically sort of pushed this pharmaceutical product far beyond where it should have gone. And there's been litigation roughly concurrent with the firearms litigation going back to the early 2000s that have sought to hold the pharma manufacturers responsible and civilly liable for the damages that their drugs have caused. Some of those lawsuits have actually succeeded. They've been brought both by individuals and by states. The pharma companies do not have an immunity bill like was provided for the firearms industry, so that's an important difference between the two different types of industries. And keep in mind, it's the immunity bill that's really being fought over in the Sandy Hook case. If there is no immunity and the case goes forward into discovery, it's probably pretty likely that Remington is going to try and settle before they reach a jury. I think Remington would be nervous about going before a jury in southern Connecticut at this point.
Professor Litton, is it fair to say that all states are watching this case very closely?
I think everybody interested in gun violence and in these types of litigation are watching this very closely. I would point out something important that I think is often missed in a lot of the debate over the litigation against the firearms industry, which is that before the passage of the immunity bill, no plaintiff ever secured an unreversed jury verdict against a manufacturer for negligent marketing of their products. So this litigation was occurring in the late 90s and early 2000s before Congress granted the industry immunity, and the litigation never prevailed. The plaintiffs never won a single case. The few cases that survived dismissal at the trial level were reversed on appeal by state and federal courts. So even if the plaintiffs in this case can get past immunity, we've never seen plaintiffs actually win one of these cases.
Professor Linton, please stay with us. We'd like to get your thoughts on the interviews that we have coming up. As I mentioned a few moments ago, we have a number of guests today, and we have a lot more to talk about. We'd like to get your thoughts. You can email us at tfs@wshu.org, or you can find us on Twitter at FullStoryWSHU. And I should mention that we did invite Remington to be with us today. We did not hear back, but the invite remains open. Let's bring in two more guests. Michael Hammond is the legislative counsel for Gun Owners of America. Gun Owners of America was formed back in 1975. It's a nonprofit lobbying organization dedicated to preserving and defending the Second Amendment rights of gun owners. And Rich Burgess is the president of Connecticut Carry Incorporated, also a nonprofit headquartered in Connecticut and devoted to educating and protecting Second Amendment rights in Connecticut. Mr. Hammond, Mr. Burgess, thank you for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Michael Hammond, your reaction to the Connecticut court ruling, please.
We had filed an amicus brief in Connecticut, and I should say also that I was involved in setting up the parliamentary procedure in the Senate for passage of the 2005-2006 Act. And whereas I had suggested at the time that they drop a couple of the exceptions, which I thought were overly broad, it seems to me fairly clear, first of all, that the case is going to be appealed to the Supreme Court. Ordinarily, that's sort of a Hail Mary pass because the Supreme Court doesn't grant certiorari in very many cases. In this case, I think there is a greater chance that it will hear the case because of, first of all, the transparently political nature of the decision by four Connecticut, basically political appointees, three by Donald Malloy, and secondly, because of its clear misconstruction of a federal statute. And so under the circumstances, I think the next thing that will happen is we'll ask the Supreme Court to determine whether or not this decision is valid or not. Because if it goes ahead, then I can tell you the 2005-2006 Act is effectively null and void.
Rich Burgess, your reaction, please.
Well, I think I would go on a less legal aspect of this. I think Michael there has it pretty much covered with everything he said. I'm a little more worried about some of these allegations of military weapons of war. Actually, the professor who was just on, I think, mentioned high degree of lethality. None of this stuff makes any sense. People who actually understand firearms, AR-15s in general, and many others that have been banned recently in Connecticut, we're all sitting here scratching our heads going, what are you guys talking about? Military weapons, weapons of war, an AR-15 has never been carried by any army in the history of man. We're all very confused by that. The high degree of lethality that people are talking about out of essentially a .22 caliber cartridge It's a 223 round, which is actually smaller in diameter than an actual 22 cartridge. We're all kind of confused why these people need to lie about things to get their case heard. That's where I'm more worried, especially in the face of Connecticut and the gun ban bills we've had here.
Mr. Hammond, the lead attorney in the Connecticut case, has said that this shows that, and I want to read his quote, that even with the statutory protection, not even the gun industry is above the law. What do you think about his statement?
We haven't said we're above the law. What we've said is even the Connecticut Supreme Court is not above the law. It needs to comply with federal statutes. Now, to recapitulate what the professor said, the statute, which I was instrumental in helping pass, created an exception for someone who, quote, knowingly, remember the word knowingly, violated, remember the word violated, a state statute applicable to sale or marketing. Now, the Connecticut state statute prohibits unfair or deceptive acts or practices. I don't think anyone has said that Remington made a factually incorrect statement. And what the central argument by the plaintiffs is that Remington has a liability because it tried to generally market its products as desirable, and therefore there was a desire by Remington that its guns fall within the hands of mass murderers, school shooters, or other criminals. That's what they would have to demonstrate in order to achieve liability under this, because the negligence standard is not enough. Knowingly was specifically written into the federal statute, and a negligence standard would not be enough to incur liability for Remington.
Mr. Hammond, I just want to be clear. Do you believe that gun manufacturers should have any restrictions on how they market their products?
Well, I don't think they should be prohibited from marketing their products as neat or desirable or cool because some criminal element might listen to that and find the guns desirable. Specifically, I mean, if you look at the Newtown Killer, the reason he chose AR-15s was not because of the way Remington marketed them, but because he was obsessed by the attention given by the press to previous shooters. And guess what? In places like Columbine and so on and so forth, those shooters had used AR-15s. So he was motivated by the press coverage and the desire to get more press coverage and the realization that as a result of Connecticut's gun control laws, he could shoot up that school without any fear that anyone would fire back.
Rich Burgess, I want to ask you the same question. Should gun manufacturers have any restrictions on how they market their products?
None come to my mind. I think Michael summed it up pretty well. I do want to point out that, you know, the Sandy Hook shooter here, he did not purchase the rifle. So I can't even imagine why people think that somehow their marketing affected his judgment. He shot his mother and stole it. He shot his mother with a 22 bolt-action rifle, from what I recall. I don't understand what the relevance is in whatever Remington marketed and his decision to shoot his mother. And also, just in general, that the objective of these cases, in my opinion, and I think a vast majority of the people that agree with our side, this isn't about winning this case. That's not what the plaintiffs are trying to do. The point is trying to bankrupt corporations through just incessant and horrible litigation that they know they can't win. Because there is no sound stage to get on this stuff about, you know, the whole case is just built on nonsense.
So, just to be clear, because we're going to get a reaction from Mark Barton, who's going to join us in our last segment. He's the father of Daniel, who lost his life at Sandy Hook. You're saying that the plaintiffs, basically those who are suing, basically want to bankrupt Remington. You believe that's what the end game is?
Absolutely, and that's why the PLCAA was created, was to keep these kind of frivolous lawsuits from bankrupting corporations that haven't done anything wrong. I mean, trying to sue a car company because somebody was out drunk driving, it's ridiculous.
Mr.
Hammond, are you currently or are you going to be working with legislators to try and enact new legislation to give further protection to gun manufacturers?
No, we think the current legislation is more than sufficient if interpreted by a court which doesn't have a political agenda.
Rich Burgess, is there anything that you are doing on the local level in Connecticut?
I would definitely agree with Mr. Hammond. I think all the laws that are in place are set there for a reason. I think they're more than sufficient, but I think Connecticut Carry will continue to work on trying to expose and get rid of corrupt activist judges who, you know, we've had judges that actually say outright in Connecticut that they are anti-gun rights and are actually out there to remove firearms from people at any chance they get. So that would be the action that I would see us taking.
I wonder if I could make just a brief comment
Please.
In response to a few of the things that have been said.
Please.
So,
Professor Letton.
Both Mr. Hammond and Mr. Burgess point out that they're very skeptical of the idea that anyone could possibly think that the type of marketing and distribution practices in the firearms industry are either unfair trade practices or unethical methods of doing business, or that they in any way cause the violence to occur. And I think it's probably the case that people disagree about that, that there are some people who think that these are absurd claims and that there's no way you could argue that the types of normal marketing practices for these weapons either encourage people or cause people to do harm or to misuse them criminally. And I think there are other people who believe that actually the ways in which these weapons are marketed and designed and the distribution practices actually increase the risk of their misuse. The real legal question here is the question not of what you believe on either side of that debate. It's a question of who gets to decide the answer to that question. And traditionally in the United States legal system, juries get to decide that question in tort trials brought by civil litigants. And in this case, we have a special circumstance, and that special circumstance is that the Congress of the United States has granted immunity to an entire industry from a certain form of litigation. Now, Congress has done that before. This isn't the first time. Congress, for example, wanted to protect the pharmaceutical industry from lawsuits growing out of vaccine injuries, and as a result, they granted immunity from lawsuits for vaccine injuries to pharma companies. They did the same thing with the airline industry after 9/11, and they said that we want to protect the airline industry from this kind of crippling litigation, and so you can't bring a civil lawsuit. In both of those cases, however, the Congress of the United States granted some form of alternative compensation to the victims. For vaccine injury victims, they granted a compensation fund. If you get injured by a vaccine, you can't sue the pharma manufacturer, but you can get compensation from the federal government. And the same thing is true in the 9/11 fund. The only time the United States Congress has ever granted immunity from these sorts of lawsuits and taken away this decision from civil juries is in the case of the firearms industry. And in that case, they have not provided any form of alternative compensation to gun violence victims. So I think part of what's fueling this debate and the drive for litigation is not to bankrupt the firearms industry. I think the drive is to bring this decision back to civil juries, as opposed to just deciding that civil juries in all other cases get to decide this issue of whether you think companies are responsible and what their responsibilities and obligations are to the public, or whether or not you think that civil juries ought to be able to do that. So I think that's an important thing to keep in mind, that there's a disagreement in the United States about whether the firearms industry is responsible, and the real question in this litigation is who ought to decide the answer to that question, civil juries or should it be decided by Congress with no compensation for victims?
Professor Linton, hold on, please. We only have 1 minute left. Michael Hammond, Legislative Counsel for Gunners. Please go ahead. We only have 30 seconds.
First of all, it's the legislature that decides, and the legislature spoke loud and clear in the face of, at the time, there were 36 state, municipal, and county lawsuits, all of them frivolous, all of them brought for the purposes of bankrupting the industry by basically forcing them to spend money they didn't have. So Congress clearly spoke.
Was held in contempt for filing a frivolous lawsuit in the history of this litigation.
It's being held in contempt for filing a frivolous lawsuit is a little different
than
filing a frivolous lawsuit.
There's been no legal finding of a frivolous lawsuit in this litigation.
Gentlemen,
that's because all the litigation was made unlawful in 2006.
Gentlemen, hold on 1 second. I want to get final comments from Rich Burgess. Rich Burgess, please.
I absolutely agree with him. And, you know, the single issue here is that, again, they are trying to bankrupt the corporations. They're not winning these cases. They never were winning these cases. There's litigation out there or legislation out there that bans these kind of cases from winning. What are we all arguing about? Let's get over it and start, you know, moving forward.
Rich Burgess.
I don't understand why we're still talking about it.
Rich Burgess is president of Connecticut Carry. Michael Hammond is legislative counsel for Gun Owners of America. Professor Linton is still going to be with us. Gentlemen, thank you for your time today. It's the full story on WSHU. We'll be right back. This is the full story on WSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak. We have a number of guests today, and continuing with us is Professor of Law Timothy Linton, Georgia State University, the editor of Suing the Gun Industry, A Battle at the Crossroads of Gun Control and Mass Torts. Professor, you've been very generous with your time today. Thank you. Also joining us today is Mark Barnin. He's here with us in the studio. Mark lost his son Daniel in the Sandy Hook shooting. Mark is the co-founder of Sandy Hook Promise, and he's been our guest before, and it's always a pleasure, Mark, to have you back here.
Hi,
under
Ron.
Sad circumstances, obviously, but it's always good to see you.
Appreciate that.
What does the ruling mean to you?
I think it's just, it's righteous, and it's very important to basically just to uncover the marketing practices of Remington, which we know are reckless and irresponsible. And I'll tell you how it started for us is my wife, Jackie, in the aftermath of Daniel's murder at Sandy Hook Elementary School, was wondering how does a kid around the corner get his hands on an AR-15. And she started just looking at the Remington website and started seeing the marketing language that they use. Now, remember that Daniel's shooter was a lonely, violence-prone, disenfranchised 20-year-old man. And pair that with the marketing language that Remington uses, words like get your man card, language like forces of opposition bow down, language like the next best thing to enlisting, and words like testosterone and all this masculine violence-driven, basically, and all the graphics and the artwork that went with it, they were marketing combat. And we see this play itself out over and over again, where these violence-prone young men respond to that advertising, and they choose that weapon to do their shooting spree. And, you know, it should also be pointed out that there is a higher degree of lethality to this, and you can look this up, but there's because of the muzzle velocity that 223 round is discharged at, it generates a shockwave in the air around it, and that shockwave does immeasurable damage to tissue when it impacts it. So it is more lethal. And it is the same platform that our fighting forces use in combat as well. I've spoken to Marines who prefer the semi-automatic platform with a high-capacity magazine, which is exactly what that is.
From what many have said on the program today and from what I have read, it appears that this may go to the U.S. Supreme Court. This could be another lengthy legal battle. Have you ever said, you know, I'm tired of this. I've been fighting the good fight. Any thought at any point ever saying, could we come to a settlement?
I think this is about exposure to these, you know, I just want to get to discovery so we can look behind the curtain and see what these marketing practices look like and what that documentation looks like and how they are marketing these weapons to the public for public consumption and public use. I think it's very important that we have our day in court, that we get to expose that and learn about it. Professor Linton said that they've been historically very secretive about their marketing practices. The placket doesn't give them complete immunity to do whatever they want. You know, there has to be accountability for reckless and unfair and irresponsible marketing practices.
So what do you think that you will find in the discovery phase?
I wouldn't even begin to say what I expect to find. I think nobody knows. I think it's, and that's why we need to do this. That's why we need to look at how they market this weapon.
Professor Linton, your reaction to what Mark is saying, please.
I think one of the things that Mark points out is very important here, which is that one of the implications of the litigation, even when plaintiffs were losing these cases, either they were being turned down in summary judgment or they were being turned down by juries, is that the discovery process offers plaintiffs in the civil litigation system an opportunity to try and open up information that government regulators may not get to. And so there have been attempts before to try and open up the marketing strategies of the gun industry. I would point out, however, that even what's considered some of the most damning information that's come out about distribution practices and, in one case, knowledge by one of the firearms manufacturers that a certain amount of their weapons were finding their way into the black market and that that was an important part of their market share, none of that has really changed much of the discourse or the regulatory approach to firearms in the United States. And it's unclear what it is that discovery is going to find out more than what's splashed all over the net. I think part of what's going on here is a real distinction in gun culture. I think there are some people who go on the web or they see advertising for firearms that talk about lethality and combat sort of taking people on with high-capacity firearms, and they are shocked by this, and they cannot imagine what the proper place of this is in a civilized society. I live in Georgia, in a part of the country where I think a lot of people think that that's really akin to what it looks like when you look at fast sports car advertisements, where the car is being shown going extremely quickly and handling tough weather conditions, that this is really just sort of the sexy part of essentially what's an ordinary consumer product. And that division in gun culture is likely, I think, to be exacerbated as discovery goes forward, if it goes through, that as we learn more about what's going on in the gun industry, I think some people are going to see it as normal marketing of firearms that makes them exciting to people who want to buy them. And other people are going to be shocked by this and consider it to be unreasonable and worthy of liability.
Just out of, if you can clarify this for me, is there a chance that in discovery that nothing new will be found? That what you said before, that the marketing is what it is, and that if all the documents are gone through, there may be nothing there. Is that a possibility?
Well, let's say we find emails or memos from the marketing department saying that they really want to push this gun among the segment of purchasers who are young men who are high on testosterone, of military age, who would be really turned on by a high-powered weapon that they could sort of play-act combat with. I don't think too many people would be surprised if we found such a memo. It seems to me that that's the type of marketing that's going on. And I think half the country would be abhorred, you know, would find this abhorrent and be shocked by it. And the other half of the country would say, well, what did you think was going on? That's the type of product that they're selling. That's what makes it exciting to purchase.
Mark?
I think there should be a distinction between marketing a product as sexy and exciting and lethal and deadly and marketing combat. I think there should be a distinction, especially because we see the outcome play itself out over and over and over again, where mass killers choose that platform to kill as many people as they can in a short amount of time. And we just have to, I think we have to see some accountability and discretion for how they market that product.
In case you're just joining us, Mark Barton is with us. He's the co-founder of Sandy Hook Promise, Professor Timothy Litton, Professor of Law, Georgia State University, the editor of Suing the Gun Industry, A Battle at the Crossroads of Gun Control and Mass Torts. Mark, you heard our guests in the segment before this, and they said that the people, you and the others who are suing Remington, trying to get this information, that you want to bankrupt Remington. Are you trying to bankrupt Remington?
No, not at all. I not even remotely. I want to bring accountability to their marketing practices.
You want the information?
I want the information. I want my day in court, and I want them to be accountable for the way that they market that product.
But when you say accountable, could you just explain what that means?
Yeah, that they should be held accountable for marketing violence and combat to these individuals that we've articulated already. And if you want to market it as, I heard one of your previous guests say the words neat and cool. So use those words. Don't say the next best thing to enlisting, you know, when seconds count and the opposition is, you know, that's a very different marketing campaign and approach. And I would like the outcome for them to have to be held to a different threshold or standard for what kind of language and what kind of practices they use in their marketing campaigns.
Professor Litton, I keep going back to what you said before about the opioid industry, and I'm thinking about kids and vaping and so on, and how this may be used, this ruling may be used across the board, if you will.
Well, actually, I don't think this ruling needs to be used across the board. The opioid litigation and what we may expect from vaping is likely to go forward without too much trouble. Opioid industry has already been held liable in a number of instances in lawsuits brought against them. And I think many people have considered the over-promotion of opioids or now marketing campaigns for vaping aimed at teenage users to be relatively straightforward and at least clearer and less protected by congressional immunity than the firearms industry. The firearms case is a little more difficult, I think, for two reasons. One is we have this immunity bill. We have a congressional, you know, we have basically a federal law that protects this industry in a way that no other industry is protected. It's been singled out for protection. But the other thing is I think it's much less clear to people as to whether or not these types of marketing practices cause injury. What we do know is that there are some public health studies that suggest that the greater firing capacity, that is the number of rounds that are fired in these mass shootings, lead to higher number of casualties, and that there is a connection between the firepower of a weapon, meaning the number of rounds that it fires, and the number of people who are injured. But we don't know a whole lot more. That is, we don't have particularly good studies, at least not that have drawn a consensus, about the effect of marketing and distribution practices on public health and gun violence injury. We don't have a lot of good studies that people think are well done on the relationship between advertising and violence. And one of the reasons we don't is that Congress passed a law cutting off all federal funding for public health research in the firearms area. We have a lot of public health research in the federal government that's dedicated to pharmaceutical misuse or to drunk driving or other forms of injury, but the federal government is prohibited from conducting public health studies about the relationship between gun marketing and industry practices and gun violence victims. And the reason for that is that the industry and the gun lobby have basically convinced Congress to cut off all funding from the CDC. I think it would be fair to say that there's a lot that we don't know about guns, and we probably know less about guns in some ways from a public health point of view than we know about opioids or vaping. And one of the reasons for that is that federal government is not funding it, and probably everybody would be well served by greater federal attention and funding to research so that we can learn more about this connection.
Mark, I'm assuming that you're in favor of what the professor is talking about.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the latest data tells us that close to 40,000 Americans die every year to gun-related tragedies. I think about two-thirds of those are suicides. But we do need to be able to study this as a public health crisis, and we do need the CDC to be funded to be able to do that so we can inform our choices from a research data perspective.
What's your message to those who manufacture guns? And I'm not talking about Remington, but to other manufacturers across the United States and possibly around the world now that this case is proceeding.
Well, we're not trying to inhibit manufacturing of firearms. We're not trying to bankrupt anybody. I just believe that the immunity that the firearms industry enjoys shouldn't give them free license to do whatever they want, and that there should be a threshold of responsibility and accountability to how they market the single most deadly consumer product known to man.
But from what the gentlemen who were on in the segment before this were saying, it sounds like you have a ways to go to convince them that that is actually your message.
I'm not interested in convincing them. They're putting words in my mouth. They've already made up their mind of what the Sandy Hook shooters' intentions were. They can't know that. They don't. So I'm not really concerned with what they think with regard to my motives. I'm telling you my motives. It's to. We want our day in court. We want discovery to proceed so that we can examine the marketing practices, the internal documents of Remington and how they market this product.
Professor Linton, as someone who has studied this for quite a number of years now, and I should say that your book came out, was it in 2005 or 2006? I forget.
2006.
The book is Suing the Gun Industry, A Battle at the Crossroads of Gun Control and Mass Torts. As someone who has been working on this for quite a number of years, how have you seen a change in the last 10 to 15 years since the book has come out?
Well, the book came out right around the time that Congress passed the federal immunity law. And as a result, much of the litigation dried up, either right away or shortly thereafter. There have been a trickle of lawsuits. There have been a few cases that have been brought against retail stores, one in particular against Badger Guns in Milwaukee, in which the store was held liable for a straw purchase, that is selling a weapon to an eligible purchaser who was buying it for somebody who was ineligible to buy the gun, and that gun was used to shoot two police officers. The police officers brought a lawsuit and they won against the gun store. There has been some litigation out of Sutherland, Texas as well against the Air Force and the gun store in that case, but for the most part there hasn't been any successful litigation against manufacturers. The Sandy Hook case is really an outlier. I would point out on the question of bankruptcy that's been brought up a number of times, it may not be the purpose or the motive of the plaintiffs here to bankrupt the companies, but in this type of litigation, bankruptcy is often a result. The liability exposure in cases of mass injury, like mass shootings or in the opioid crisis, or in other instances where lawsuits have been brought where the carnage or the damage has been widespread, bankruptcy is often something that happens to the defendants, and whether or not it's intended, the threat of bankrupting the industry is probably part of what motivated the immunity bill in the first place. To take an example from another area of civil litigation, the widespread lawsuits against the Catholic Church for clergy sexual abuse have resulted in bankruptcies of dioceses all around the country, and the Catholic Church is a lot wealthier than the firearms industry. So I think it would be expected that if the litigation goes forward in Connecticut, and if it pops up in other states as a result of this decision, we're likely to see some bankruptcies in the industry.
Mark, we have about 2 minutes left. You and I have spoken in the past, and your message has always been very clear. And when it comes to Sandy Hook Promise, you stress education, education for teens, education for anyone who has guns, mental health, talking to parents, letting people know what's going on. Is that still the framework that we're talking about, just educating people, getting to know the signs?
Yeah, and it should be clear that this Remington lawsuit has nothing to do with my work in my organization. This is my wife and I are doing this personally. But yes, Sandy Hook Promise is all about school safety and education. We bring programs into schools at no charge to train kids how to recognize warning signs of somebody who might be thinking about hurting themselves, getting them connected to the help that they need before it becomes a tragedy, and building more connected communities within those schools by training kids how to look out for one another.
And I just so we can clarify for everyone who's listening, so it's separate from Sandy Hook Promise, and how many others are there in the lawsuit with you?
I don't know the actual number of plaintiffs. There are several other families and some other members of the community involved in the litigation as well.
And you obviously are going to continue this until the end, until you want to get to the discovery phase, and you don't know what you're going to find, but
yeah,
you're going to look.
Exactly.
Okay. And Professor Linton, final thoughts from you, sir.
Yeah, as was mentioned before, this is likely to be appealed to the Supreme Court. The question here about whether or not there's immunity or not is a question of interpreting a federal statute, and the final word of that is the Supreme Court of the United States. There's some lack of clarity as to whether or not the Supreme Court would take this on appeal now or after trial. And if it takes it now, there's also some possibility that the defendants would be able to get a stay, which might prevent discovery. So some of those questions are open and up in the air, and I think those are the things that we probably would want to look out for, whether or not this is going to be appealed right away and whether or not the Supreme Court would seek to impose a stay that would stop discovery, or whether or not they would allow discovery to proceed while there's an appeal pending.
Professor Linton, you were very generous with your time today. We appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Timothy Linton, professor of law, Georgia State University, editor of Suing the Gun Industry, A Battle at the Crossroads of Gun Control and Mass Torts. Dave Altomare was with us at the beginning of the program. He's a reporter for the Hartford Courant. Michael Hammond was or is the legislative counsel for Gun Owners of America. And Rich Burgess is the president of Connecticut Carry. And Mark Barden is the co-founder of Sandy Hook Promise, father of Daniel, who was killed at Sandy Hook. Mark, thank you.
Thank you, Ron.
Always appreciate your time. That's it for our show today. Julie Ferdino is our engineer. Carrie Frank is a digital editor. Our associate producers are Christian Carter, Sabrina Garone, Natalie Chafari. J.D. Allen is the producer. Ann Lopez is the senior producer. Terry Sheridan, our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to all of you for being part of The Full Story.